Children, we're starting.
That's right.
Showtime!
Another Fresh Picked Pod from audio2u.com. Shutters Inc. with Shelton Muller.
Might wish to stay on and listen.
Hi, and welcome to the post-world tour episode 99 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from audio2.com back again. And with me on the line, Shelton Muller. How are you?
Hey, I've been missing you, Bruce. That's how I am. I've been missing our podcast. I've been missing you, our regular interactions. I've been missing keeping in touch with the Shutters Inc. fraternity. I've been sitting here just, you know, biting my nails and hoping for your return.
Well, that's lovely.
You had a great time by the looks of things.
Oh, mate, with the exception of Qantas, we had an awesome time.
Oh, don't now, really, because, Qantas, according to Dustin Hoffman, is the only airline to fly. What happened?
Well, look, generally, yeah, I would agree. You know, Qantas have always been very good.
Qantas, got to fly Qantas.
Yeah, my feeling is that they are becoming more shareholder-focused and less passenger-focused.
Right.
There were certain things just, you know, on my flight across, on Kath and Max's flight across, they were not given any night packs at all. And of course, these days you can't take toothpaste on board the plane.
No.
And so if they don't give you a night pack, then you can't brush your teeth at all.
Mm.
And remember, for those of you who are not aware, this is like a 13-hour flight, so it is quite nice to be able to brush your teeth.
At some point.
The entertainment system didn't work particularly well on the flight home. We were told that the system hadn't been initialized by the ground crew and that they'd have to reboot it. And so it was offline for a further 15 minutes while they rebooted it. And then when it did come online, the three entertainment systems in the three seats that we were occupying weren't working while the rest of the plane was.
Fantastic.
We'd start watching a movie and it'd get, you know, 10 minutes into the movie and then suddenly it'd just reset itself, and then you'd try and start it again and it'd say, sorry, we're unable to deliver your request at this time. And and then my breakfast came and the milk was sour. The milk had gone off.
Boy, that's not a good flight.
No. And I'm actually in the process right now. I was writing as you rang me on Skype.
Yep.
Of writing a fairly nasty message or letter to Qantas. Just to say, you know, look, you
this
know,
is not on.
Pick it up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in the end, you have to ask them, what did you get what you paid for?
Yeah.
And if the answer is no, then they owe you. Mm. It's as simple as that. That's always my line when people say, oh, this, that, and the other. And I'm happy to, I'm happy for, things go wrong. That's the way it is. But when that happens, then the company has to ask, well, did the people who are paying, get what they paid for? And if the answer is no, then it's up to them to compensate to some degree.
Yeah.
You know, that's just my take on it. That's just the way it is.
In Qantas's defense, their cabin crew were always absolutely fantastic, which is the way I have always found Qantas staff to be. They've always been superb.
Yeah.
It was just, every complaint that I had, when you looked at it, it appeared to be an administrative thing more than a, staff at the coalface type issue.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
For
milk to go off and still be 2 days in date would tend to suggest to me that they're not keeping the refrigerators cold enough to keep the milk for its shelf life. So, and that's probably a cost-cutting thing. They're probably being told, run the fridges a little bit warmer so we're not using as much electricity or something stupid like that,
well,
I don't know. But anyway.
Yeah.
But look,
unusual.
apart from all of that, we had an absolutely awesome time. You know, my week of work in Ventura was great. I had great time catching up with the guys at Linda. I met some fantastic new people as well. One of the other producers at Linda, actually, he had a D200 as well.
Right.
And he brought it in one day, and I happened to see it sitting on the couch. And I went, oh, who's D200? And Chris said, oh, that's mine. And I went, oh, right. I said, the guy I do the podcast with, he's got a D200, absolutely raves about it.
Yep.
He said, yeah. He said, I'm still in the doghouse with the missus for going and buying it.
Oh, well, it's worth it.
And he said, go and fire off a few shots, see what you think.
Yep.
And so off I went and stood outside and just, had a play with it. And I can see why you love it.
Oh, yeah.
It's just gorgeous.
Well, maybe you should come across from the dark side, mate. Well, you know, and get yourself a Nikon.
I tell you, if I ever lost my camera gear again, not that I want to, but if I was in a position where I suddenly didn't have any lenses to keep me beholden to one system, I probably would jump across to Nikon.
It's a beautiful camera. It's a beautiful camera.
I can see what you say about the colours being just so natural.
Yeah,
with the 200, you know.
Yes,
because I looked at the images just on the LCD on the back of the camera, and I thought, I know what that image would look like if I'd shot it with my 7D.
Okay,
and I could just tell that the Nikon just seemed to do a better job of interpreting the colours.
That's nice. Okay, very interesting. I'm actually at this point. I got an email from the good people here in Fujifilm Australia.
Right,
and they had some S5s going at a special price.
Ooh.
And I made a deal with them that, and probably today or tomorrow we'll also be taking delivery of an S5. So I'll be having two Nikon D200s, but one of them will say Fujifilm on it, but it will have the Fuji sensor. Now, working with Greg, my good mm-hmm. friend Greg Bayer, who owns an S5, and sort of standing right next to him in the process, I tell you, there are differences in sensors between cameras that really make the choice of camera, well, more difficult, because while you like the features of one camera, you may not like, you know, the way it interprets, as you just said, the way it interprets color, its dynamic range, you know, all those, as much as, say, a camera whose features you don't like as much. But, you know, I don't know. I'm looking forward to taking delivery of the S5 and working with both cameras to see the differences between them.
Yeah.
Both Nikon and Fuji have their arguments as to, you know, which produces the better image and all that kind of thing. But Nikon essentially are using a Sony sensor. And while I was recently, you know, at a press launch on this front, they say that they give Sony certain directions regarding their sensor, and so the sensors in Sony cameras are different to the sensors in Nikon cameras. It would be an interesting thing to actually check out, to be quite honest with you.
Sony's experience in the image sensor production market would be from all of their point and shoot cameras, right? Because they've only just got into the SLR market.
Yes. Yes, but they've been producing sensors for a fair while, apparently.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, you know, and Nikon, I think, well, since the D100, as far as I know, have used the Sony sensors. But I wasn't particularly in, especially, you know, as technology improves, you know, I look back on the D100 days and realize that it had such a minimal dynamic range and, you know, very little punch. I look at the difference between the D100 and the D200. And I mean, it's chalk and cheese. But I was recently at the launch in Sydney of the D3 and the D300.
Oh, wow.
And I tell you what, these are two, the D3 particularly is just a spectacular beast.
Yeah.
There were three photographers who were.
Now, sorry, just before you go on, which is the pro model and which is the consumer model?
Right. The D3 is the pro model.
Right.
And it's a 12 megapixel CMOS sensor.
Yep.
With a whole bunch of, you know, other features, and it's the first time Nikon have what Canon proudly call full frame sensor.
Right.
We've always argued here at Shutters Inc. that every camera is a full frame, but that's my stupidity just coming to the fore. That's my my being anal again. But they've actually now got a 24 by 36 inch or inch. That'd be nice.
It's like that 12 million megapixel Sony.
Here's our 3-foot sensor, folks. They've got a 24 by 36 millimeter sensor. And the noise capabilities with this are, anybody who's been looking at the internet, are unreal. But when you see a 20 by 30 inch print of an image taken at 6400 ISO, and you look at it and there's no image, you know, or no issue with the noise. There's noise, but there's no issue with it.
Wow.
You think, wow, this is fantastic.
What size was the print?
20 by 30 inch.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, yeah, it was a 30 inch print. And I looked at it from standard viewing distance, you know, 5-6 feet away.
Yep.
And I thought, this is fantastic. So I thought, okay, let's do what everybody does and walk right up to it, which I did. And I just looked at it and said, look, there's noise, but who cares? It's a 30 inch print and it's about the same kind of noise that I'd get at 400 ISO on the D200.
Wow.
You know, 800 maybe, but not a problem. And it was just incredible. I mean, look, it's going to be $6,000 Australian or something for the body alone.
Yeah.
But beautiful. And it because it's a you know, a CMOS sensor, it requires less energy to produce an image, so therefore its noise is already reduced. The D300 is a standard APS-C size sensor, but again, because it's a CMOS sensor, and requires less energy than CCD, it does produce, you know, again, far less noise. And I haven't really had that much of a play with the D300, but they say that, again, you know, Nikon have taken a nice quantum leap forward from the D200. Now, that I'll have to see to believe, but I'm sure it's true. I'm just wondering what they would have done. You know, noise, they've certainly improved, but apparently the functionality of the D300 is even better than the D200. And I find that, you know, fascinating in that the D200 is such, as you just said, such a great camera to work with. So, it was a very, very interesting event. Nikon threw a one-year anniversary party of Nikon Australia.
Right.
Because prior to that, of course, Maxwell imported Nikon into this country, and then, of course, Nikon took over.
Yep.
So we had a party there, and you had issues with Qantas. Believe it or not, I had issues with Qantas.
Oh, really?
Well, I had an interesting few days. I flew Virgin Airlines to Rockhampton from Melbourne because once again they'd asked me to come up to run more workshops. So I flew from Melbourne to Rockhampton in Queensland to run these workshops, and when I arrived, my reflectors and my backdrops had gone missing.
Oh, no.
So I had to run workshops without my reflectors and backdrops, which is, you know, and I had to makeshift stuff and all sorts of things. Then, of course, on the way back from Rockhampton, I had to stop over in Sydney for the Nikon events. Mm-hmm. And I arrived and I flew back Qantas because Nikon paid for the flights. So I flew Qantas from Rockhampton to Sydney. And on the way, Virgin had lost the first half of my luggage. And on the way to Sydney, Qantas had lost the second half. So I arrived for a Nikon event, which requires, you know, formal gear, suit, shirt, tie, all of which I had. But of course, now that they'd lost my luggage, I had a pair of jeans and a shirt to wear to a formal event. Everybody's coming up to me at the event going, oh, hi, Shelton.
Dressing down for this one.
Dressing down for this one, I see. You're doing the bohemian photographer thing, are you? And I just sort of had explained to everybody that, you know, look, sorry, I'm a bit wrinkly and I stink, but Qantas lost my suit. So the following morning, by which time my luggage had arrived in my room, I attended the press event in full suit and tie and shoes, and I looked spectacular. But I showed everybody that, look, see, I did bring it. Okay, I'm not a complete loser. I did bring it. I just didn't have it last night. But the events were great, and you know, the three photographers, there were three photographers that Australia had, you know, that Nikon Australia had selected to test the D3 and the D300,
right.
And each of them, they gave glowing reports about these two new cameras with no real faults to speak of. And the interesting thing was that they were told by Nikon, you know, look, use the cameras, we're going to get you up, we are not going to hinder anything you say. You will be fielding questions from the audience, and you have to answer honestly. But there was no issue with any of the cameras. The photographers basically loved them, and you know, wanted to keep them, I think, because <You know? laughs> they were really great. So, and having seen the images myself, now here's the interesting thing: they did side by side comparisons of the D3. And the, you know, the Canon, the equivalent Canon.
Right.
The EOS D1 Mark
III.
Is it 3 or 2? I'm losing track, you know.
Right.
and the noise comparisons between the D3 and the equivalent Canon were incredible. You know, 6400 on the Canon, 6400 on the Nikon. And I'm telling you what, it was the same shot taken at the same time with the same person in the same conditions with two different cameras.
Right.
And the same lenses, etc. You know, the Canon equivalent of the Nikon lens, blah, blah, blah. And I was blown away by the difference. And I think seriously now, Canon are going to have a contender in the that size sensor market. And maybe for the first time, you know, pros will consider, you know, Nikon over and above the Canon. Canon have a strong foothold on the DSLR market, both in consumer and pro. Oh, okay. And I think Nikon, for the first time, are really going to make them, you know, give them something to worry about. Nikon have long had their market share because they've got loyal Nikon users, yeah, and because of the F mount, you know, which right, continue to attract photographers.
Why?
But because it's compatibility, it's backward compatibility. You know, they can continue to use the same lenses that they used
with their analog bodies.
With their analog right, bodies, yep, and even their, you know, and even bodies that were pre-autofocus, and you know,
oh, okay,
with the D200, I have a couple of really lovely E series lenses. I have a 70-150. 75-150 E series Nikon, which is as sharp as anything, and I use it on the D 200. Now it's an old 1980s lens, but it's very sharp,
right?
And it's a fantastic piece of equipment. And all you have to do is program the D 200 to that lens, and every time you put it on, it knows how to work with it.
Right.
That kind of compatibility has kept, you know, Nikon users, you know, being Nikon users. Now, however, though, I think they're going to basically be saying, hello, look at us, even if you're not a Nikon user, hey, look at what we've done, look at what we will continue to do.
Mm.
And from the consumer perspective, they basically said that it won't be too long before there will be what Nikon call an FX size sensor version in the consumer body, or a 24x36 type millimeter sensor in a consumer body. So I'm not exactly sure where that puts the D300. But, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what they do. In other words, we're going to have a camera in Australia that'll be, you know, $2,000-$2,500 for the body.
Yeah.
That I would estimate, this is a guess, speculation, that will have an FX size sensor, and, you know, we'll have the same noise capacity, or, you know, to create images at high ISOs with low noise as the D3. So it will be interesting to see what they do. I think they're really onto something here.
Mm. You know?
So that was very, very interesting. And while you were away, of course, I've done a fair bit with off-camera flash.
Oh, okay.
And if you go to my Flickr site,
yep,
you'll see that I have a couple of wedding shots that I did.
Yes.
And a long time ago we talked about this, but if we've got a minute, I wouldn't mind just talking about what I did.
Go
and then
for
I
it.
Want to talk about your pictures of the USA, because yeah, sure, I seem to have taken over this podcast for some reason.
Yeah, so go ahead.
Well, the other night I had a situation. It was a Sunday night, and a client of mine, Settlers Run, which is a golf course here in Victoria,
right,
a client of mine said, look, we need a corporate wedding photo. We need a wedding photograph that highlights our you know, our wedding services as a venue, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we had very little time to organize it. I have a wedding dress because I need one for my wedding photography workshops.
Yeah.
So, and I sometimes just like to wear it and, you know, dance around. I'm only kidding. I'm excited. And so I had a dress. All we needed was a model and a time. So one of the staff members there, a young lady named Nairi, it's a Maori name apparently. She's blonde and blue-eyed, mm-hmm, but she's got a Maori name,
mm-hmm,
a New Zealand Maori name. She was our model, and she fit the dress, which was great. But of course, the shoot was at 7 o'clock at night, and I was looking to get some very late afternoon light. We've got daylight, yep, savings here at the moment, so it was a good time to sort of start getting into the shoot. But it was a cloudy night,
mm,
and I thought, well, what I'm going to do actually is work with that. I love the drama in the clouds,
yeah,
but I haven't got any warm light. So I set my SB 600 off on a tripod to camera right, and I put a bit of orange cellophane over the flash,
nice,
and there was my sunset. It was a fantastic experience because I've used this technique before of off camera flash and even, you know, with the orange cellophane, but never on a wedding. And for some reason, it on this particular occasion, it really worked well, and I used it in different ways. What I did, I got a very low angle on a lot of the shots, looking up at the bride, so I got the drama of the sky behind. And I set my white balance on auto, And then I, which was just to sort of see what the camera measured the scene as, I set the exposure at one stop under so that the scene behind would be, you know, darkened and mooded up a little bit. And then I put the orange cellophane and elastic band, highly technical,
Yes.
You know, 6 square inches of or 6 inches of cellophane and an elastic band. I put my I had two tripods. I've got a new carbon fiber Manfrotto that I love, and I've got I had my other Manfrotto with the with the flash on it. You know, off to my right, I've got the bride looking over her shoulder into the flash, and basically set that up as my pseudo sunset. But so I used different colored temperature settings, which was really great. But it was also the I eventually actually even used tungsten as a color temperature setting,
right,
which really gave the sky and everything that wasn't illuminated by the flash a very blue and moody feel.
Yeah.
And again, it's on my Flickr site, anybody wanting to see, but I'll upload it to you too, Bruce, so we can put it on audio to you. And there's the variations between using I basically just used the flash on ITTL and let it do what it had to do, let the camera talk to the flash. I didn't take over that process in any way, but I used the camera manually, underexposed the ambient light by a stop so that you know, it would be a little bit darker and she would be further highlighted against a very dramatic sky. I used it off to her side, and then I also set the flash up behind her. So that she and the dress hid the tripod in the flash, but it rim lit like a sunset room, her, and it looks very natural. And I'm going to do this more often. It was really, you know, something quite you know, quite wonderful. I really enjoyed the process. And when I showed Nairi the photographs on the back of the camera, she couldn't believe that, you know, what I had produced in camera was so different to where she was standing and so dramatic. I mean, it was a beautiful evening, but I had further dramatized the setting by the combination of underexposure and off-camera flash and the warmth of the light from the flash, just using a bit of, like I say, a bit of orange cellophane. It was a very simple process, but, you know, I suppose, well, everything's simple when you know how. But, you know, it was a very simple process, but in camera, right there and then, produced a very dynamic image. And the company has, you know, now put it into their advertising brochure. The thing was, of course, that it had to be shot on Sunday night because they needed the images Monday morning.
Right.
Monday morning, I had to get up at 4 o'clock to get on a plane to do a shoot in Sydney.
Oh.
So I had to finish the shoot Sunday night, go home, process it, Photoshop it, upload it to a website so that they could download it and have it ready for themselves Monday morning. So that's the digital age we live in, and everybody thinks, well, now that we can do it, let's do it, you know.
Yeah.
So, but it worked well, and I invite everyone to go to my Flickr site. I think I've also uploaded it to the Shutters Inc. Flickr site, so they'd be there as well if you wanted to look at them. And any questions you have on that process, let me know, because it's not the only time I've used that process. In fact, the following Monday, the day after, in Sydney, I had an industrial shoot. And I couldn't take my flash heads with me because it would have been a lot to lug around, and we had to do a lot of photography in one day. We had different locations. I had to get this shot and back on the plane, you know, and finished before I left. So I took two SB speed lights, two Nikon speed lights with me, two tripods, and basically used that as my lighting system all day. We worked with a young model, a young Sydney model. She works a lot out of Hong Kong these days, she was saying, which was interesting. But she had never seen, you know, she'd been on a lot of shoots, but she'd never seen a photographer just set up two Nikon speed lights on tripods and just use them, you know, bouncing and, and you know, direct and that kind of thing in various combinations. She'd never seen a simple lighting setup like that used so effectively. And I have become quite a fan of, you know, really simplifying and using off-camera speed lights, little handheld flash guns, as your main lighting systems. It's really working for me, and I think I'll be doing it a lot more. But that particular day, we had an industrial shot to do, and it was just a boring photo of a man inspecting an air conditioning duct and setup, you know.
Right.
And I thought, how do you make this, you know, how do you make this rock, you know, because they want to, you know, what do you make it, what do you do? And I thought, well, why don't I just do what I did last night, which was, set the camera on tungsten. We were up on top of a building, so I had sky behind me. Set the camera on tungsten, put the orange cellophane on, and away you go. Well, yeah, I did exactly the same thing. I underexposed the ambient. I put the flash directly on him, so it was very spotlight type effect. I had it like just an inch or so off camera, so you couldn't see the flash, making it very direct and very hard. And I, you know, produced the shot that way. And again, showed it to my client on the back of the camera. That's what I've come up with. Do you like it? And he couldn't believe it. You know, that something that I'd taken 2 minutes to set up could be so dynamic. And he was standing there and it looked nothing like what we were actually standing in. So it's a very, very powerful way to use flash. It's a very powerful way to add dynamics to, you know, an otherwise boring image. And I think I'll be doing a lot more of it. You know, I'm going to get myself a couple more speed lights, I think, and really work this system. And if you don't have an ITTL or sort of a through-the-lens wireless system, there are some really great products that you can buy. There's actually a remote flash system you can buy that has a transmitter and receiver. You can buy them on eBay. You can get them off the internet. I think they're called Cactus, C-A-C-T-U-S. And they are remote flash triggers and receivers. And they're about $30.
What brand do they work with?
Basically, any flash that you connect them to. You put the transmitter... Yep.
You can turn a non-wireless flash into a wireless flash.
Well, yeah, except, of course, that it doesn't... you have to set your exposure, right?
But
Yeah, I mean, because there's no compatibility in the exposure system. But yes, you can.
Wow.
You can take a $20 flash you buy secondhand down at the local secondhand shop, and you can use it off-camera wirelessly with this remote trigger. Now, I went and got some, and I thought I'd give it a go. And they are fantastic. For $30, I think it's about $30 US for the set. You get the transmitter and the receiver, right, for $30. All you have to do is establish the power ratio that you're going to set, full power, half power, whatever you want to do. And, you know, or you can set it up to use its, if your flash has, say, a thyristor auto setting, you can set it up for that. You can use, you can have... different receivers and transmitters. Like if you had two photographers, they can set it up so that they can fire independently but fire the same flashes, but each sends off a different signal that the flash receives. It's quite incredible.
Wow.
So if you're wanting to get into off-camera flash, but of course you don't have an ITTL or wireless flash compatibility or the budget for it, you know, because it's not cheap, this is a very cheap way of doing it. You buy a cheap flash, $20 or $30, you know, you can get them secondhand for, in, you know, flash guns. You get this transmitter and receiver, a Cactus, and you've got an off-camera flash set up without cords, without leads, and you can take it and carry it anywhere.
I'm going to have to look into that.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. on my boys' weekend away, we were doing a bit of this because we arrived, and as I said, I think in my last podcast, it was horizontal rain. So a friend of mine, Ashley Whitworth, who's a photographer friend of mine, he had these things with him. And we just set up stuff on the inside and started fooling around with flash photography inside, and it was great. It was fantastic.
Wow.
So, yeah, if you have had experience with this yourself and you're listening, let us know, because it's quite exciting and a really great way to add a lighting dynamic to your photographs. Because, of course, as we know, if photography is about writing with light, then flash is your pencil. You know, it can be anyway, and you can direct it and use it and color it any way you like. And the added bonus is that you can tell your camera what color temperature to set and fool around with that as well.
Yeah.
You know, it really is quite fantastic. So that's something that I'd love you all to consider. And, you know, if you've got images that you've taken or want to take, let me know. But I've worked with it a few times now, and it's very, very successful.
Speaking of cheap eBay purchases, I got to Ventura and got my $12 shutter release cable.
Ah!
And, oh, man, it was so good to have a shutter release cable again, because I used to have one like 10 years ago, but I've not had one recently.
Yes.
And where I found that really handy was when I was at Disneyland and we're trying to shoot the fireworks. I had my camera set up for, you know, ISO 100, and I think I was shooting at about F8 or F11 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than going with a preset time, I just set it to bulb, and then I'd open up the shutter, and just, you know, I sort of learned over successive minutes of watching these fireworks going off that I'd open the shutter up and I'd see how much light was coming to me from the fireworks, and I'd just gauge it, you know, by myself and go, yep, I reckon I've got enough light there for an exposure, and then I'd let it shut.
Yep.
And I found that really handy because in the past I've always, you know, if I've been trying to shoot, you know, fireworks, I might have gone for, say, a 15-second exposure.
Yeah.
And you open the shutter and then 2 seconds later you get this massive big burst and there's bucket loads of light and you're thinking, man, I've got another 10 seconds of this.
Yeah. I'll blow it out.
Yeah. So I found having the cable was really good.
And it worked well. You got some great fireworks shots at Disneyland.
You. Thank you.
That's really great. There's some. You do, I've just actually saw one out of the 34 that you sent me.
Yep.
There's one that I've absolutely fallen in love with, and you have done a world-class job here, mate. And it's the shot looking down the highway into the sunrise, sunset. Don't know.
Which image number is it?
18.
18. Oh, and yes. Yes.
That is gorgeous.
Thank you.
That is just
this
beautiful.
Was in Oregon near Mount Hood. Mm-hmm. And we drove up into the mountains, and it was crazy. You know, you just see terrain in the US that you just don't get in Australia.
No.
You know, we left, you know, Portland, which is at sea level, and within, you know, an hour and a half, we're in roads covered with snow and ice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The same thing happened to Nathan and I when we were in Jasper last year, Jasper and Banff in Canada. Yeah. And you ascend, and then there's a little bit of rain, and then suddenly you think, oh, hang on, the rain is changing. What's happening? It's falling slower. Yeah. And, becomes snow, and it's just gorgeous.
Yeah.
That is a beautiful shot, mate. Tell me a little bit about it. How did you meet her for it? Can you remember?
Yeah, well, basically what happened was we pulled up on the side of the road. I'm just trying to think. No, I didn't send them to you. Just to the right of where that shot is taken, there was this little bit of a pathway that ran off, like a roadway, but just an off-road track. And the snow was quite deep there. And Max had never played in snow.
Yeah.
And so I pulled the car up and said, you know, I said, oh, Max, come and play in the snow, you know. So we got out and we had a snow fight, and he just thought that was sensational fun, you know, being able to throw snow at Dad. And, you know, he just had a ball. And then Kath got out. Oh, that's right, because Kath was sitting in the car and she was playing with the GPS. So we started throwing snowballs at the passenger side window of the car, which eventually prompted her to get out and join us. And so then her and Max started having a snow fight. So I thought, oh, I've got to grab the camera and get a photo of this. So I ripped off a couple of shots. And then as I turned back towards the car, I happened to look down that road and see the light just sort of hitting the trees on the left-hand side and went, oh, wow, that's cool. And so basically I just metered for that, you know, the green of those trees in the middle distance on the left-hand side of the road, because I figure that was probably my neutral grey, my 18%.
Very good.
And just went with that.
And so just, have you been learning from a photographer or something, all these
techniques? I must have been.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, that's fantastic, mate. That's really great. That is a beautiful shot.
Yeah.
Beautiful shot. Well done.
Thank you. Yeah, and
that's sunset, I presume. You weren't up that early?
No, that was sunset. Sun going down over Oregon. Yep.
Ah, that is really gorgeous. The composition is excellent too. You've got the leading line going off. and you've got the leading line going off into the golden mean third. You haven't even got it going into the center where most people would put it.
Yeah.
You've got it going off into that, you know, that golden mean third. It's beautifully metered, lovely colors, nicely composed. I mean, a lot of people would stand there and say, isn't that beautiful, and take the shot and get it wrong. but you've taken that opportunity and got it right. It's really gorgeous.
Oh, thank you.
Really gorgeous. So you've done some beautiful stuff. How was Yosemite? We talked so much about Yosemite before you left. Tell me a little bit about it now that you've returned.
The thing, you know, in hindsight, well, let me backtrack. We always knew that this holiday was going to be manic. We were just cramming so much into a 2-week period, you know.
Yes.
And in hindsight, if I have a regret, it's that we didn't allow enough time for Yosemite. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, get there in the afternoon, shoot the sunrise, and then hit the road would be enough. Mm-hmm. And that was just not doing Yosemite justice.
No.
It is just an awe-inspiring place. As I said on the blog, there are places you go to and you get blown away by what you see with the naked eye, and you photograph it, and you can look at that photo later on and go, yeah, I... And even if you took a really stunning shot, you look at it and you go, yeah, but it's just not the same as being there, you know?
No,
and
it isn't.
Yosemite is one of those places, you know? You stand at the bottom of El Capitan, and you look up at this thing that just goes vertically for a kilometre into the air, and you're just like, whoa.
Yes, that is incredible. Yeah. It is. It makes you feel so small.
I am this puny human being.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. But you did, I mean, for the time that you were there, you did very, very well. I am a fan of your USA 29 of 34,
right,
which has the autumn leaves in the foreground, the reflection of, is it Half Dome?
I'm not sure. It might be.
I think it's Half Dome.
To be honest, I was... This was like 6 o'clock in the morning. I was freezing cold. I regret, you know, I absolutely loathed having to take the gloves off to adjust settings on the camera.
You need a pair of low pro gloves, mate.
Oh, do I?
Low pro make a set of gloves for photographers with little rubber beads on the fingers so that you can keep your gloves on and still work in the cold.
That's what I need. Okay, so so basically I was just driving along this road and I saw this creek bed down on the left hand side and just stopped and pulled up and walked down and just saw that and went, yep, there's a great shot there. And
Nice perspective, nice composition, lovely colors. You did a lovely job.
Thank you. Very nice job. Thank you. Very good.
So, you know, well done.
The thing that I probably should have researched a little bit more was what time of the morning the sunlight would actually start hitting the peaks, because it was actually not hitting the peaks until about 8 o'clock.
Okay.
So I'd been up since 5 o'clock going, do-do-do-do-do, waiting. So in the process, you know, I was just driving around the park and looking for, you know, for great light at various stages of the sunrise, you know, and just trying to make the most of it. The shot before that, 28, I, you know, deliberately...
like that. I really like that.
Do you?
Yeah.
I was really trying to get the ice in the foreground, like that, that circle in the water there is where it hasn't frozen over and all of the rest of it is ice.
You did well. Maybe I would only suggest you crop a little more of the sky, but it tends to take my attention away from the reflection in the broken ice.
Right.
But you know, even maybe go square and cut the whole thing out altogether. I don't know, but it's you know, nicely seen, very nicely seen. And you were at the sequoias. Is that what you're looking up at here? The big sequoias. Did you go there?
I'm thinking is that, image 20. No, this is we'd left Crescent City at the north side of California, and we were heading down the coast towards San Fran. And we knew we had a long day on the road. We had about a 7-hour trip to get to San Francisco.
Yeah,
and not far south of Crescent City, there was a tourist attraction called the Mystery of Trees, and Max wanted to stop and to go and have a look, and so we. We got out and we had a look, and I said to Kath, you know, what's the deal with this place? Because she'd gone inside and come back out, and she said, oh, it's a walk. You pay, you know, $15 or whatever, and you then get to do this walk through the trees and blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, how long does it take? And she said, 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, you know, I want to do it, but I really don't want to add 90 minutes to my 7-hour drive, you know. So we said, no, look, sorry, Max, we're not going to do it. We'll keep going.
Mm-hmm.
So we jumped back in the car, and seriously, about 5 minutes down the road, there was this, you know, road leading off to the right, which was like a tourist drive. Mm-hmm. And so Kat said, let's do that. Let's just get off the highway. And I went, okay, fine. So we're driving down this tourist road.
She's a smart lady.
And we're only 2 minutes down the road, and there's this sign that says, Big Tree. I'm thinking, well, that sounds relatively descriptive. Let's go and have a look. So off we go, and we found this tree that was 92 meters tall.
Mm.
And I don't think I sent you the shot, but I got Kath and Max. I set the tripod up, and I said to Max and Kath, go over by the tree. And I said, Max, I want you to stand right in the middle of the tree, and I want you to stretch both arms out wide, you know,
yep.
And then I got Kath on one side of him and got her to stretch her arms out. And then I put the camera on 10-second timer and I raced over and stood on the other side of Max. So you've got the three of us, arms outstretched with just our fingertips touching each other. And we're not as wide as the tree.
Wow.
Yeah. So I probably should have sent you that shot. But but yeah, it was just gorgeous. You know, these beautiful big, you know, Californian redwoods. And it was just, yeah, awe-inspiring stuff.
Well, I'd love to see the photo of the three of you across the tree.
Yeah, for sure.
That would be terrific. Now, another one that I love, and I'm sure you're going to put all these on your Flickr site.
I'll throw them up, yeah.
You know, and audio to you, but it's about time. You've still only got one picture on your Flickr site, haven't you?
I know. I've been slack.
Yeah, so it's about time that you got with the program there, mate, all right? So put these on your Flickr site.
Okay.
The 22 of 34, Jack's Bar.
Yeah.
Tell us a little about that. I love that. Very film noir. Film noir.
That was, I think that was San Francisco, down near Fisherman's Wharf.
Right.
And we got into San Fran that night, and...
It's San Fran now, is it?
Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. I just have to get up with the American lingo there, buddy. That's okay.
Sorry, the people who live there are probably very offended by me saying that. So we got into San Francisco that night. We checked into the hotel, and Kat said, let's just go for a walk. So I went, okay, no worries. So I thought, well, can't go for a walk and not take the camera.
Yeah.
And she had kind of suggested that we would head down towards Fisherman's Wharf. And I'd looked at the map and thought, that looks like about a 12-block walk.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, we got down there and, yeah, I was just walking along and just saw that. And it's unlike me, but I immediately imagined it as a black and white shot.
But you pre-visualized.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just thought, yeah, I can imagine this coming out, you know, really sort of seedy, dark underworld type look.
That's,
you know,
great.
And all apologies to the management of Jack's Bar.
All we needed was some, I don't know, like a hooker standing leaning against the wall or something. Would have just added that sort of sleazy sort of, you know, darkness to it. Would have been or some bogey character with a cigarette, you know. You should have just, I don't know, you should
or just
have
the legs of a body lying on the ground on the left-hand side.
Very Mac the Knife, yeah. Well, that's a great shot. Two more I want to talk about particularly is the panorama of, what was it called, Crater Lake?
Oh, Crater Lake was just sensational.
Mm.
That was just an amazing place. Oh, actually, did I send you Crater? I don't think that's
in
this.
I've got a panorama here.
Oh, yes, it is. Yes, number 19.
Lake. Yep, I think you said it was Crater Lake.
19?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, that is Crater Lake. We got up there and there was about 5 inches of snow on the ground when we got up there. And so we got up into the car park and I, you know, naturally grabbed the camera and tripod and headed off over to the sort of that top of that rim looking down over the lake.
Yep.
And as I said on the blog, it was a fairly bleak, overcast day. And the only thing I really did to that image was to put a bit of blue into the sky just to stop it looking so flat and dull.
Yep.
But yeah, other than that, I just, you know, put the camera body on its side and shot about 8 frames from memory and then just, yeah, stitched it all together in Photoshop.
Very nice. Very, very nice indeed. By the way, I've learned something over the last few weeks, well, maybe a couple of months that I've been doing with skies, particularly if it's a cloudy sky.
Yep.
Select it. You can even just use the magic wand to select
yes.
it, feather it, and then apply image. Apply image. And it really, yeah, especially if you do it as a duplicate layer. It's sort of like...
Is it like multiply mode?
Multiply mode. It's sort of like multiply mode in layers. And it's really fantastic.
Right.
I've been doing that a lot. So not that you need it in this image, but in some of the, you know, sky stuff, it really is quite fantastic.
I guess it probably comes in handy if you don't have a lot of texture in the clouds.
Exactly. What it does, you'll find that it actually finds information in the image that you didn't think was there.
Yeah, right.
So if you've blown out a bit of cloud or whatever, try apply image and it'll find it.
Wow.
You know, it really is, even in a JPEG, it's quite incredible. You do it with a 16-bit, you know, RAW file and it will find it, that's for sure. But even in a JPEG, you'd be surprised what information is actually there. And I've found it very, very handy. Mate, there's so many images here I could talk about, but another one, of course, would be your favorite, I think, is the Alcatraz shot.
Oh,
now, that is really good.
The exercise yard.
The exercise yard. I'm sure the exercise yard has a lot of history and not a very pleasant history either.
Yeah.
But it's a great shot. And what I want to know is, how did you get it devoid of people? Because there would have been tours running.
Well, yeah. I didn't have to Photoshop anyone out. I actually got it like that. There was no one in there at the time.
Mm.
The interesting thing about the Alcatraz tour is that you pay your ticket for your ferry ride across, and you're not actually given a guided tour as such. You basically are just dropped at the island, and you can stay for as short a period or as long a period as you want, because the ferry's coming and going every half an hour.
Uh-huh.
So basically, you can take as much time on the island as you want during your day.
That's good.
But you've got to be off the island on the last ferry.
Mm-hmm.
And what they have is, when you get inside the building, is a free audio tour. And what's involved there is they give you an MP3 player on a lanyard that you can hang around your neck. Mm-hmm. And they tell you, you know, when you get to the top of this staircase, press play. So you press play and you've got your little headphones on, and you get this commentary from, you know, former wardens of Alcatraz, and, you know, and also bits of dialogue from former inmates of Alcatraz. And they give you this running commentary, and he tells you where to walk. You know, walk down until you come to the opening through the thing called the cut through, and turn right and go through there. And he said, and then you'll find this bit. And then he starts rabbiting on about that.
What happened and here this, in 1952. Yeah, and
And from an audio engineer's point of view, it was a really nicely produced audio tour. They had some really good use of sound effects and atmospheres, and it was really well done. And this audio tour ran for about probably 50 minutes, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it took you through all of the main parts of the building itself. But not,
did you go to the Birdman's cell?
Yep, past all of that. And so anyway, once we'd finished the audio tour, we hadn't really seen any of the outside. We'd really just walked through the interior of the building. So I decided, I'm just going to wander around the rest of the island and see what else is here. And the pathway kind of led us down one side of the island and then up this massive long staircase, which brought me up right from where this shot is taken at the far end of the exercise ground.
Yes.
And just at the time that I walked up and into there, there was no one there, and I went, wow.
Grabbed that shot.
Yeah. And so just grabbed it, and, you know, obviously the raw image didn't look as doomy and gloomy as this shot does, because
you've added some noise
and
just,
you know,
boosted the contrast a little.
Yeah, and just,
but your composition and the way the light is falling on that side of the building gives it a really good three-dimensional look. Mm. So it's very nice, and I love your perspective, you know.
Thank you.
Your composition, the leading line going from the bottom left corner, that sort of, you know, you've got these geometric lines that are going right through to lead the eye through the image. Very nicely done.
Well, thank you.
Very, very nicely done. I'm very, very impressed with what you've done there, mate. That's fantastic. That's really great. Now, there's so many good images here. There really are. Is there anything particular you want to talk about that we haven't touched on?
I'm just having a quick flick through. The third image is Bob Fisher's house, which I just loved Bob's house.
Yeah, and a special g'day to Bob, I imagine.
Absolutely, yes. Very remiss of me. Bob, thank you so much for your hospitality, mate, and for driving me around the place to get all these great images. We just had a ball.
Yeah.
Met some very colourful characters who are friends of Bob's, and you know, we went out to Joshua Tree National Park.
Did Bob take you out there?
He did take me out there.
Fantastic. He is the photo meister, isn't he?
He is.
Good on you, Bob.
So I'm still waiting to see the images that he shot of me at Joshua Tree. But, we have probably the one image that we haven't spoken about that I do like is number 6, which is of a Joshua Tree with the sun behind it. I'm really happy with that shot.
That's lovely. And the star effect naturally produced, I imagine, through by the aperture. What did you choose, F11, something like that?
I think it was either F11 or F13.
Yeah, which produces a natural star effect when you do that.
Yeah.
You know? And that's beautiful, mate. That really is
just
quite gorgeous.
Nice silhouette.
Yeah. Very, very nice. A portrait of Bob here, of course.
Yes.
With one square lens, one round lens on his glasses.
That's Bob.
I love that. That's fantastic.
We were in this little coffee shop on the Sunday morning having a coffee, and this guy came in and he had these glasses on, and you've probably seen the image on Bob's Flickr stream. This guy had rescued this pair of glasses from a car accident, and he duct taped them back together. So all around the edges of the actual lenses of these glasses was this black duct tape. And and Bob said, "Oh man, I love your glasses. Can I take a photo of you?" And so that's why Bob had gone off and grabbed his camera, and I naturally grabbed mine as well.
Right.
And so I thought, I just got to rip off a shot of Bob while he's, you know, setting up to take a shot of this guy with his duct taped glasses.
Yes, fantastic, fantastic. Oh, there's some really great stuff there, mate. You had a good time. Now, what did you learn? You've come back, you've shot these fantastic things. I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Yep.
What did you learn from shooting? Well, it's sort of like you had a travel shoot, really, didn't you?
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah.
If you could come back with a handful of lessons, or even just one, is there anything that stands out to you?
Well, I guess it would be not to rush my shots. I was continually... It was always in the back of my mind that we were on such a tight schedule, you know, because we had so much ground to cover on our travel days, and we had so much to see on the days when we were actually, you know, in a particular location. So there was a tendency at times to rush shots.
Right.
And so there were, you know, there were shots that were, you know, opportunities that were missed because I rushed them. And, you know, the ones where I just went, nah, stuff it, I'm taking the time to get this right. It, you know, obviously paid off to a much greater degree. And the other thing that really struck me, and this is obviously your influence rubbing off on me, was there were things that I looked at and thought, that's a great, you know, piece of Americana, or it's a great building or whatever, and it was something that I would have liked to have shot, but because of where I was and when I was there and the light not being particularly complimentary, there were times where I just went, as much as I'd like a shot of that, this isn't going to work because the light's wrong.
Yeah.
And I would just pass it by.
Nice.
And you know, because there were things like Kath would point something out and she'd go, "Oh, look at that, isn't that really nice?" And I'd go, "Yeah, it is, but the light's wrong."
Did she think you were sort of weird? Or?
Well, she said, "So you're not going to take a shot of it?" And I said, "Look, I will if you want me to, but I said, I just know it's not going to work." And she just trusted my judgment on that. And you know, like you, she's absolutely stoked with what I've shot.
Yeah.
And it's not like we've come back and gone, gee, we don't have any images of XYZ, because I did shoot, you know, almost everywhere we went.
Yeah.
With the exception of the Jet Propulsion Laboratories at NASA. So
they wouldn't probably let you do that.
No. I didn't even bother asking.
No.
With the hoops we had to jump through just to get through the door.
Right.
Yeah, it was just amazing. But it was a fascinating tour.
Yes, I can imagine.
My contact there, Dr. Lopez, she's on, for any space buffs, she's on the Cassini project. Right. That's the probe that's currently out at Jupiter and just heading out towards Neptune now.
Right.
And, yeah, and she's a member of that team. And she was on the Gemini team before that. So after we finally got cleared at security desk, we went up to her office because there was some paperwork she had to finish off. And we walk into this hallway and she shows me this image, like this printout on a, you know, large format printer of a photograph. And this photograph was probably 6 or 7 feet wide and probably 5 feet high. And it was a high-res color image of a crater 1 kilometer wide on the surface of Mars in... high-res color.
Wow.
And she points to this little gray speck that on this particular, you know, 6 foot by 5 foot printout, this little gray speck was probably a centimeter and a half across. And
right.
She said, "See that there? That's the Mars rover sitting at the edge of the crater."
Oh.
I'm thinking, wow, that's pretty cool.
That's, wow, that is cool.
And anyway, she took us down and she took us through the museum of the JPL, which is what the public get to see when they do a tour.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in there they had a life-size replica of the second-gen Mars rover and, some other models and things. And then we left there and she took us down to the spacecraft assembly building. So this is the building where they actually put the probes together before they ship them off to the launch site in Florida. There was nothing under construction at the time. But this building is like 20 meters high. It's like this big open atrium, except it is a sealed room. And she said, you know, when a space probe is under construction in here, everyone inside has to be in suits, and it's a completely hermetically sealed environment. And people with allergies love to get a day working in there, because after a day in there, you're just right as rain, you know.
Yeah.
So we were just in this little glass viewing booth on the side of that. So that was pretty interesting. And then she took us up to this building, and I hope I don't get her into trouble saying this. And this building had a sign on the outside that said, "This building is closed to tours until further notice." And she just swiped a card and ushers us inside.
Fantastic.
And then we walked through the foyer, and there was this little corridor. It was only about a meter wide, and it went up a carpeted staircase. And she goes, "Yeah, come up here." So we walk up there, and we find ourselves in the viewing platform overlooking Mission Control.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we're looking down on these banks of computer monitors, and there's all these geeks down there doing their stuff, and there's like all these screens up the front, and you know, a couple of large screens with like real-time clocks counting how long the two probes that they've currently got up there have been since launch, you know, in days, hours, minutes, and seconds. And oh, it was just wow.
And you couldn't take a picture.
And you couldn't take a picture, yeah.
So. Oh, well, that's life. But you got to see it. You got some pictures in your head. Well, you had a fantastic time.
Oh, mate, I did. Holiday of a lifetime.
Yeah, sounds like it. And no doubt there'll be more. You'll be thinking about more stuff in the podcast that we do in the weeks to come.
Mm.
That you'll be thinking, oh, I've got to talk about that. You know, you'll look at a photo and go,
probably.
Oh.
Probably.
Yeah. Oh, got to mention that next time I'm, you know, doing Shutter Zinc.
Yep.
But you did some really great stuff. And look, like you say, when you're traveling, it really is a case of what to leave in, what to leave out.
Yep.
And to stop and breathe and take a picture, you know, think it through. Even if it, you know, takes you a minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes to think it through, better to get one great image after a good thought process, you know, or work process, because, you know, you might take a few images before you actually, you know, to get the one that you're really thinking of. And then, yeah, it's better to have, you know, half a dozen great pictures than 30 average ones. So
yeah, exactly.
You've done really, really well. I'm very proud of you, Brooke.
Thank you.
Very
mate.
Proud of you indeed. But we do need to see these now on your Flickr site, okay?
All right.
And no doubt you'll add some others. But there's some great stuff here, mate. Really good stuff.
Thank you.
Well done. Well done. So make sure you get onto Bruce's Flickr site, and if he hasn't put them up by the time you get there, just give him some stick.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's an Australian way of saying give him hell.
Yeah. We better wrap this up because we've been talking for an hour already.
Yeah, if people are on their way to the work, they're going to have to listen to the end of it on the way home.
That's right. But before we go, next week, of course, is episode 100.
Mm-hmm.
We will have a prize. I have no idea because we haven't even spoken about that yet. So hopefully,
we'll be announcing both the prize and the winner.
Yeah, so I'll get all of those images through to you after I finish recording, and then next week we can discuss all of the images we've received and pick a winner and take it from there.
Yeah, are you entering, by the way? I mean, I could never choose you as a winner, but you've got some great landscapes here, mate.
Oh, well,
be a bit funny if I announced, and the winner is Bruce Williams.
Well, maybe I'll dig out a landscape that hasn't been seen so far.
Okay.
Slip it
but
in
you
there.
You can't win, Bruce, no matter how good the image is. People would be screaming rigged from the rooftops.
Maybe what I'll do is I'll put one in under an alias and see if you can pick which one is my image.
Okay.
All right, mate. Well, it's good to be back. Good to talk to you.
If the alias is, you know, William Bruce, I think I'll know who you are, mate.
All right.
Good to talk to you, mate. Welcome back to Australia. Welcome back to Down Under, and I'm glad you had a good time. And it's nice to be back talking to everybody again. Please keep up the interaction. For those who emailed me for ideas regarding future podcasts, like yourself, Walt, thank you very much. I will get onto these. I know Walt in Newfoundland has a wedding coming up next year, so we'll be handling a few of your inquiries in the weeks to come too, so you can get started on your practice for that wedding, Walt. So don't worry, all of your requests for future podcasts have been duly noted and we'll get onto them. I just needed to get this over and done with Bruce so we could talk about his experience and we could all learn from it. So thank you very much again, and it's nice to be back.
Absolutely. And we'll talk with you all again next week.
You bet.
See ya.
See you soon.
Now, how much of that did you understand?
Audio to You delivers the best quality podcasts direct to your desktop or portable. You be the boss. Hear what you want to hear.
When you want to hear.
Hit us today. And remember, Control D to bookmark. AudioToYou.com.
It's all over, Marge. It's all over.